Hello and welcome to CDH Conversations. I am Yvonne Mkefa, a director in the employment law practice. In commemoration of Women's Month, CDH is proud to bring you a special series of episodes dedicated to women's empowerment. At CDH, we believe that the issues affecting women deserve attention and recognition throughout the year. The series will also feature men discussing their roles as allies in support of women's causes. And today, we are joined by Nadine Mohammed, who is a director in our Employment Law Practice and Knowledge Management Department. Nadine, can you just introduce yourself?
Sure. Thanks, Yvonne. This sounds like a great series. And in terms of myself, I majored in philosophy and did an LLB. I worked primarily as an employment lawyer in a few firms before arriving at CDH a while ago. I was also a legal researcher to Justice Chris Chafta at the Constitutional Court. And I also did some academic work where I did a doctoral dissertation in religion studies, and I focused on gender and sexuality in religion, law, and society, which I also published on, and I also taught at the African Gender Institute at the University of Cape Town.
Well, we definitely have an ally in you, Nadine. So for these conversations, we just want to explore some strategies to combat workplace harassment and promote an equal and safe working environment for women. And perhaps let me pose this question. What are the most effective legal frameworks and policies that employers can implement to proactively prevent workplace harassment? And how can these be tailored to address the unique challenges faced by women?
I think it's important to start off with our constitution. And sometimes our constitution is not given the importance or the primacy that it deserves. The Constitution and the Bill of Rights clearly prohibits discrimination on the basis of certain characteristics that implicate women as well as men. But in certain circumstances, these can be more prevalent as a ground of discrimination when it comes to women, such as gender, sex, and marital status. The ethos of our legal framework is committed towards eradicating unfair discrimination based on gender and enhancing the presence and position of women in the workplace. In terms of another piece of legislation, the Employment Equity Act, further grounds on which discrimination is prohibited are listed. Again, some of these grounds particularly refer or implicate women, at least to some extent. And two of these grounds, one is pregnancy and the other is family responsibility. In addition to this, the Employment Equity Act clearly indicates that harassment in the workplace, including sexual harassment and harassment on the basis of race, gender, and sex, constitutes unfair discrimination. And so what this means is that employers must take steps to eliminate harassment from the workplace, including sexual harassment, which is unwelcome conduct of a sexual nature that violates the rights of an employee and constitutes a barrier to equality in the workplace, as well as harassment on the basis, or at least based on gender and sex. Now, women are generally in the position where they are victims of sexual harassment, and sexual harassment can be unwelcome innuendos, suggestions, or hints. These can also take the form of sexual advances or comments with sexual overtones, or even jokes or insults that are directed towards a particular person or towards the category of people who are all women that are sexual orientated in nature. And all of these types of behavior, whether it be physical, verbal, conduct-based, whether it be the way someone relates to someone else, or it could also be in the form of writing, all of these forms of harassment should not be condoned in any way. And an employer should have clear policies which regulate this type of conduct and make it quite well known that they are unacceptable. But further on, we also have other forms of harassment that may not be necessarily sexual in nature, but that are grounded in some sort of gender bias. And what one finds in a workplace sometimes, or in some workplaces more than in others, is that gender stereotypes are quite prolific. The way people interact with each other, the assumptions that are made in respect of what people are capable of, people's capacity and intelligence, are sometimes commented upon on the basis of gender. And these are really based on gender stereotypes that have no valid basis or no founding. you also find instances where employees or people in the workplace or stakeholders or other people who interact with the workplace, whether they be clients or whether they be suppliers or whether they be contractors or consultants, may make use of sexist language or conduct or even issue a joke or say something in passing that they may think is quite light, but in fact it's not. It's rather offensive towards women in that it is grounded in offensive gender stereotypes, in that it has explicit sexist language, or that it makes assumptions about women that are untrue and that are offensive and that are sexist. There are also three things that employers need to be particularly aware of when it comes to women in the workplace and gender in the workplace. The first is to exclude people on the basis of gender, specifically women, either from a work project or either from, you know, participating in decision-making. And if the only reason or the primary reason, the more fundamental reason for the exclusion or marginalization is on the basis of gender, that is highly problematic. And that's something an employer needs to be aware of and take into account. The second is, and we've heard this many times, the gender pay gap. And this is not a South African issue, it's a global issue where women are oftentimes remunerated less favorably compared to men when they occupy either the same position or even do the same type of work. And the Employment Equity Act is quite clear on this, that equal pay for equal work is important to ensuring an equitable workplace, and that an employer who does not ensure that takes place could be guilty of discrimination. So equal pay for equal work, ensuring that women are remunerated fairly and in line with their male counterparts, and that gender is not a basis on which women are remunerated unfairly or treated unfairly in the workplace, especially in relation to acknowledging their worth. The third thing which is connected to that is also promotional opportunities. And I think this is extremely important, that we find that in many instances, women are unfavorably treated in relation to promotional opportunities in there on the basis of gender, especially if you have a workplace that's quite male orientated and where they have a view of women as not being able to be good managers or take on leadership roles, again, grounded in stereotypes of gender and women that's completely unfounded, but also where people view women as a risk, inverted commas. You know, or women have more family, or traditionally at least have more family commitments, or they may in the future be pregnant. And, you know, that's an operational problem for the employer. And in that way, what the employer does, it constructs a women and gender in this instance as a handicap. And that's highly problematic and it's very unfair. And so an employer should be aware of that and ensure that those type of issues or those type of factors are not really what's guiding opportunities and the inclusion of women and entry of women and retention of women in the workplace. Perhaps, Yvonne, you know, you can tell us a little bit about how legal professionals, you know, can ensure that the workplace is safe for women, that we have harassment policies in place, and they're not only compliant with this and the legislative framework, but also foster a genuinely inclusive and supportive environment for women. And in your experience, you know, what do you think are some of the things that employers can do beyond just a compliance framework for better inclusion?
Thanks, Nidim. I think what is encouraging, and we've seen this developing over time, is that employers are compliant insofar as having these policies, and our laws are very clear on what needs to be contained in those policies and the codes that regulate or guide employers in relation to these issues, quite direct and also instructive. I know that they are seen as guidelines, but they're actually quite instructive that you can actually use them to make sure that you are compliant as an employer. But that just makes the policy compliant and the provisions of those policies quite clinical. And we've also seen that over time, that policies that are clinical, and when clients or employers come and seek for advice, sometimes you cannot fit in some of these cases squarely within the parameters of the policy. And that's critical, right? Because that makes us to take a pause. We have to take a pause and establish what is it that we can do to make sure that we foster a generally inclusive and supportive environment for women. And I recall there was a time when we were in my previous life running an awareness campaign for people with disability and about people with disability in a workplace. And one of the slogans that was used at the time was "Nothing for us without us." Don't create policies and campaigns and activations about us without involving us. And that for me made a mark, because we often, as a profession, because we are exposed to the laws and we know how the courts are dealing with these matters, and we have a tendency of coming up with solutions that addresses what the courts are saying without necessarily looking in and finding out what are the impacted people, what is their lived experience. So policies are meant to ensure not just compliance, but make a workplace a lived experience in such a way that a person believes that they're included and they also that they belong. Further, that they're also safe. So from that slogan, I can only say that when we come up with these policies as employers, we should not just confine ourselves to the normal collective bargaining processes and just speak and engage and consult with who we are required to consult with or solicit information from. In the normal course, you'd have employer formations where from a collective bargaining, you'd go to speak to trade unions. What is important is that we do need to know how women are experiencing the workplace from a harassment perspective, and let that also shape how policies are being crafted, because that's going to be their lived experience. So what we've seen also with organizations, they actually start groups, they call them employee resource groups, where they would consult with women, or in some instances, they also consult with allies. So if they know that there are various employee resource groups, they will actually take those policies. I'll give you an example. So the requirement from a policy perspective, one is investigating or is conducting an investigation on sexual harassment. There's a requirement that this must be done confidentially and sensitively. We all assume what does that mean, but you'll be surprised if you were to ask women, what does that look like for someone who has been through this or someone who has worked with someone who has done this? So that's critical. So my slogan is that anything for us must be with us, so that we know that we are considering everything that is going to make the workplace inclusive and supportive. So Nadim, I mean, looking at what we've discussed so far, in your experience, in cases where workplace harassment occurs, what are the best practices for legal recourse and support that can empower women to come forward without fear of retaliation or career setbacks?
I think in the first instance, sexist stereotypes, which are in and of themselves prejudices and biases and which are invalid, must be avoided. So when harassment occurs, irrespective of the type or the manner of harassment, it must not be ignored or treated differently because the person reporting it or the victim may be a woman. You know, certain stereotypical kind of cliched responses that she's overreacting or sentiments of that sort really must not come into play and must be avoided completely. So that's important. Equally, I'll say that the employer shouldn't be guided by certain negative stereotypes in the way that women act. So because it's not stereotypical for women to be perpetrators of sexual harassment, for example, in the society that we come from, when something like this does occur, an employer should not treat it any differently on the basis that a victim of such harassment is not as seriously affected simply because the perpetrator is a woman. So that's important as well. But in addition to this, I would say the normal recommendations to any case of harassment would apply. HR or whoever the employer has designated to receive the claim or to investigate a report of harassment, they must listen carefully, they must treat it seriously, they must not trivialize the claim that has been submitted to them. Two, they should acknowledge that bringing a claim of harassment is something difficult for many people. And they should be cognizant of the fact that there may be a delay in a victim reporting harassment, because there's all sorts of feelings of perhaps inadequacy, of shame, of why a person may not bring this the employer's attention immediately, and an employee needs to be aware of that. The third thing is they need to find out if the person who's reporting it is afraid of any retaliation and reassure the person that they will not be prejudiced for lodging a claim of harassment. It shouldn't have a chilling effect where people say, or especially in this case where women are the victims of harassment or sexual harassment or some sort of grievance that's directed at them simply on the basis of the fact that they are women. They should not feel that it will not be taken seriously. They should not feel that there will be some sort of retaliation or it will affect upward mobility or promotional opportunities, or they will be seen differently because they are now bringing a claim of harassment or reporting something. So that's really, really important. The fourth thing I would say is that people need to be sensitive around issues of confidentiality, as you've mentioned, Yvonne, as well as the person's position, especially where the victim may be in a reduced position of power compared to the perpetrator. So then that must be acknowledged. The employer must be aware of that, and the direction with which the employer takes the harassment claim needs to take that into consideration. And perhaps the final thing I'll say in this regard is that the employer needs to determine the effect of the harassment on the victim. They need to determine whether the victim will need emotional or professional support. They need to determine whether the victim is in a position to continue working or continue working in the same working environment without any changes, especially where we have a case where the person who's reporting the harassment, where the woman may be reporting directly to the person whom she's complained about. And so those type of things need to be also taken into consideration where possible, especially in relation to the emotional and professional support, where it's possible for the employer to render that support or to make arrangements for that support to be furnished to the victim, be done in a sensitive way. All of those things are important. But Yvonne, I want to go back to something that you mentioned earlier, which is extremely important, you know, that beyond compliance, that there are systemic issues of gender inequality in our society and in the workplace. And that it's really important that when we're advocating for changes or for improvements, or where we have a strategy to enhance the presence of women in the workplace in a meaningful way, that this is not done by a group of men without any consultation with women. That, you know, nothing about us without us kind of situation, as you've mentioned. And so given that, I mean, how do you think the legal system, how do you think the workplace policies can be improved to better address systemic issues of gender inequality and harassment in the workplace? And what do you see that legal professionals can do to contribute towards this, to advocate for better change?
Thanks, Nidim. I think the starting blocks, I mean, we must commend what the legal system has accomplished over time in terms of we now have the legal framework. And the legal framework, as you have said previously when we started, it actually is quite substantive. You are able to make reference all the way from the Constitution, from our rights to equality, all the way to the codes that are at a very shop floor level, at the workplace level, where not only the managers, but the employees are able to understand when they are being trained what is actually required of each and everyone who's actually in the workplace. So I think from a legal framework and the legal system, there's definitely room for improvement. And because these matters involve people and people themselves are dynamic, so you cannot always be married to a legal system as it stands today, because as things change, the legal system also has to change and improve to meet the people in relation to what their needs are and within those legal parameters. From a systemic perspective, so when something is systemic, it means it has developed over time and it is embedded. And for it to shift, it almost needs a disruption. You mentioned pay parity. That phenomenon has developed over many decades. And we can see even with the reports, whether it's in South Africa or in the UK or abroad, there are real efforts to change this inequality in relation to pay. And we have legislation in South Africa that is requiring employers to look into it. We also have companies beginning to report on how they're closing the gap. And all of that is in an effort to change the system. And it is very slow because it is a system. And that is critical for us to know, right, that even as professionals, as legal professionals, while we are beholden to instructions from clients and when we get consulted on policies, on matters, that we must listen to our clients and seek to meet the requirements of our client. But what we must also be conscious of is that by the very nature of our profession, we are change agents. We are very influential and have the power to change the world around us. And we can also shape the what I call workplace PTY Limited. How we provide this advice, we must move with an understanding and appreciation that there's still a lot that needs to be done for the systematic inequality based on gender and harassment perpetuated in the workplace. There's quite a lot of work that still needs to be done. So when you are living consciously in that way, I did a course with the University of Stellenbosch about responsible leadership and how, what does that mean? So when you are accepting or appreciative of the fact that you are also a change agent, when a client instructs you, for instance, to review a policy, and you can actually see that the benefits that have been provided for in the policy or the terms of a contract have been placed before you where you need to settle an agreement, they perpetuate inequality, whether subtly or covertly, that as a legal profession, we actually have to make our client aware. And I'm saying making our client aware because when something becomes systematic, people actually miss it. When you say, this is how we've always done it. And because when people are in an environment for long and things have seem to have been working, no one wants to disrupt that. So as legal professionals, it is important that we are also conscious about how we give advice. There's a term that I think we started hearing about responsible advice, responsible lawyering, as they used to say it colloquially, that in whatever that you do, you must make sure that you don't become one who perpetuates this inequality and maybe in a way become an ally as you do your business in the flow of your work. So that for me is critical because all of these things like promotional opportunities, all of those things are in policies, pay, the REM policies, they regulate pay across in organizations. And that is critical that when we see it, we have to call it out and advise accordingly. I think from what we have discussed so far, I see that there's a balance, right, of what you do legally and what you do ethically as professionals, what we do ethically and legally as professionals, and what is it that we are saying to employers. So what I want to hear from you is that what are the key legal and ethical considerations for companies when they design their training programs and their reporting mechanisms, because it's that obligation to ensure that they are effective and trustworthy for women employees.
So Yvonne, I think in the first instance, the first thing I would say is that as it's a point that you've mentioned and it's a point that I've also indicated earlier, that it is essential for women to be included in the design, in thinking through what the cause of the training or the elements of a policy are going to be. I think that's fundamental. Secondly, you know, we do have legislative framework around affirmative action, which recognizes historical disadvantage. And one of the bases on which it recognizes people were excluded from the workforce historically, or at least from certain parts of the workforce, was on the basis of gender. And part of that legislation, part of the aim of that legislation is to obtain a more representative workforce at all levels of management and workers. But I think it's equally important to recognize the intersection of race and disability with gender, because at times this compounds the othering and the discrimination and the marginalization that women of color and women who have disabilities suffer. It's a double social burden that often many women need to bear. And so it's important to recognize that in addition to the gender, there are ways in which race and disability intersect with it that make it even more challenging and difficult for certain women to access workplaces, to feel integrated and included in workspaces, and to feel acknowledged. Finally, what I'd say is that it's something you've mentioned as well, Yvonne, and I think it's crucial, is that employers need to move beyond rhetoric. So, you know, you have various compliance frameworks, but an employer shouldn't be seen as just being at the minimum compliant, or that it complies because there's a stick that's making it comply, that there are negative consequences if they do not comply. An employer needs to be seen. If you really want a workplace that's truly inclusive of women and that truly respects women, you need a workplace and you need an employer that's seen to value these things above and beyond simple compliance measures. A genuine commitment to gender equality in a work environment that is considerate of family responsibilities, which in many instances, women shoulder more significantly than men. And there's also increasing awareness of certain physiological experiences which are particular to women. And employers need to grapple with what that means for women in respect of upward mobility, presence in the workplace, and work pressures. And an employer's policies, openness, support, and practice on these things ultimately point to a value system that takes gender equality and women's experiences seriously. So it is those type of things that would render more visible an employer's true intention when it comes to gender equality. And I'd say that while it is imperative for women to be a part of these discussions and movements, it is also important for men to ensure that this is an integral part of workplace culture and planning. Gender equality and the challenges experienced by women as a result of patriarchal biases should not only be left to women to challenge and resolve, and it is far more ethically sound for men to also contribute towards this effort. And I think if you have something like that, we would have a far, far better workplace generally in our country and across sectors.
Thank you so much. Just my parting shorts, I think you've wrapped it up quite well, is that it actually takes a very brave employer to design a program that truly seeks to root out these inequalities and harassment in the workplace. And I say so because we have seen sometimes where employers are just reluctant to roll out training programs because that means people then will know that what has been happening for the past 4 years actually is harassment. The law requires it, but at the same time, they're not embarking on such training programs with the view of ensuring that the workplace, because that must be the drive, making sure that the workplace is safe. Even if it means for the first few months or first year, that's what you do. You are making people aware and they complain and you are addressing those complaints. That's good because in the long term, the workplace needs to allow women to flourish. I cannot imagine someone coming to work for 4 years feeling like they cannot be at their optimal best. And that the transparency about the reporting, because when you report and you see improvement, your workforce is going to be encouraged. And your women specifically will also be encouraged and know that they, as an employer, you take their safety in the workplace quite seriously. I just want to say thank you for having this conversation with me, Nadim. And you are truly an ally. And I'm looking forward to having a similar conversation some other time. Thank you so much.
It's only a pleasure. Thank you so much, Yvonne. Thank you for having me.
The views and information expressed are those of the contributors at the time of publication and do not necessarily present those of the firm. All content is provided for general purposes only and does not constitute legal advice. We make no representations, warranties, or guarantees, whether expressed or implied, that the content on our podcast is accurate, complete, up-to-date, or reflects the current law. We accept no responsibility for any loss or damage, whether direct or consequential, arising from reliance on the information which is presented here.